You're beautiful. We don't tell each other that enough, but you're beautiful. When we come together as believers, it's an amazing thing. And for those of us, like myself, who have spent time with so many on a reservation where I've come from just recently, it's wonderful to spend time with believers. It's absolutely a joy for me. And so it's always important for me to share that with you because of the possibility of what can take place when believers gather. This morning, when your pastor had talked to me a little bit about what this opportunity was going to be about and how I could share, I was excited. He said, normally I have one service and I have one lesson and I just kind of do one for the one and one for the next and it's the same. And I can't do that because I don't know. It seems like, you know, when you're preparing and looking at the Word and you're thinking about your day-to-day activities and the week in front of you. So I'm speaking a little bit in this first service about doubt. And hopefully my next service will be a little bit more on prayer. But in order for me to share with you about what doubt means to me, I have to give you a little reference to my own personal life. You see, I don't, it was never in the mindset of Paul Mitchell years ago growing up in Manhattan, Kansas, to ever aspire to a position to speak about God or let alone the power of the cross. But what I can tell you, and so I use this part of my testimony, as I will in the next service, that I love to drink. There was nothing more important to me than drinking. I used to start my high school years, and by my freshman year in high school, I was always trying to figure out what I could mix with Everclear and my drink during the week. And what I came to, the conclusion was, it doesn't matter. When you mix with Everclear, it doesn't matter. It's irrelevant. I loved to drink. And I didn't want to spend time with people. It wasn't a social thing. I just wanted to be by myself to drink. And this was the beginning of my freshman year. And this enormous need to drink. It went on. I eventually became a very successful alcoholic. And when I use the term successful, I mean all the things that come with addiction, that it can blossom in your life, I did well. I still managed to gratify my flesh, even in the area of marriage. And even in that time, I spent time getting to know a young girl, and we had three children together, and I stayed drunk the entire time, just constantly drinking, out of a relationship with God, missing the mark continually. I don't share that as a form of a badge. My father is a preacher, the Church of Christ, raised in the church. My brother is a Southern Baptist pastor down in Wichita, Kansas. And they were so faithful to spend time with me and encourage me. It didn't matter. And so in 2002, in the summer of 2002, I found myself sliding through the front windshield of my car out onto the hood, having drank vodka the entire time from Manhattan, Kansas, trying to get up to see my folks in Iowa. I stumbled off the hood of the car. You know how it is. You hear the horrible stories that the person who's inebriated somehow manages to survive horrendous accidents, but they manage to hurt so many around them. And as I stumbled up that rock road, a farmer and his young daughter saw me, and they came running, and no way to communicate what was going on. I was in shock. I'd split from my right here on my cheekbone all the way up here and around the back of my head, and so this portion in my ear was hanging off. And when the paramedics came, they first responders, and they brought a helicopter ride in for me. And I ended up in Liberty Hospital down in Liberty, Kansas, just north of Kansas City. And I spent time there. It wasn't enough. You know, I doubted a lot, sincerely. And it wouldn't be until the winter of 2003 that I finally gave my heart over to the Lord. I wish that I could have been in the presence of like this worship team that just led us. I wish that I could have been in the presence with some of you who'd know how to pour into that moment. But I wasn't. I woke up passed out in the middle of the night. The back door of my little apartment was wide open and snow was pouring into the back. The furnace was driving as hard as it could to try and keep the apartment warm. I urinated all over myself, puked all over myself. I'd bumped my head and I was bleeding. And I remember getting down on my knees. I need you, I need you, I need you. That's all I said. There were a lot of things I could have said. I could have said, God, forgive me. Jesus, forgive me. I'm in that horrible mess. Get me out. Get me sober. But I needed to get the prayer simple. I needed to understand. I needed a tangible God where I had doubted so much in my life. I needed to put my hands on something. It'd be a couple months later before I got into a program down in Missouri. And he began to open doors. Sometimes we need that tangible thing, that tangible faith. That's why you're here together. That's why you spend time coming together, to pour into each other, to have that unity, that closeness, that family feel. We need that. People like me need that struggle with addiction. In the book of John, chapter 20, in verse 24, it talks about doubting Thomas. And I just want to read a little bit here, but I'm going to get right down to the nuts and bolts of it. In verse 25, it says, so the other disciples told him, we have seen the Lord. But he said to them, this is Thomas, unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand into his side, I will not believe. A week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, peace be with you. Then he said to Thomas, put your fingers here. See my hands. Reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe. Thomas said to him, my Lord and my God. And here's the powerful statement. Then Jesus told him, this is about you and me. Then Jesus told him, because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. That's you. Some of you. You've made a choice in your life to believe, and you didn't have to have that tangible effect. My wife and I have been pastoring and starting churches on the Rosebud Reservation for the last 8 years. It is some of the hardest work I've ever done, and I've done some horrible jobs, difficult ones. I think to date there's nothing worse than working with baby calves in their first night, and you got to give them that bottle and they step on your feet and they've got the sharpest hooves, and then about a week later they can outrun you. And you got to give them shots. But I loved it. I may not have experienced the happiness that we commonly associate with what we do, but I did experience joy. I did experience the opportunity to be with those who needed the tangible God, who needed to see what the character looks like when it's been sharpened and honed and forged by Jesus and the cross. Native America struggles. I'm supposed to be sharing about Mokelum, and I'm getting there in a roundabout way. My brothers and sisters, your brothers and sisters struggle. They doubt a great deal. And why? There's a lot of reasons. You know, with all the everything in the news, and I'm not going to go on to this very much, but with the boarding schools and all the horrific tragedies that happened, they doubt. They doubt the intent and they doubt the character. You and I are called to walk into that. You and I are called to walk into those kind of messes with our brothers and sisters and be a representation of character, commitment, love, the drive of the cross. We're called to go into those dark moments where there's ferocious anger and resentment. We're called to be with them. You see, we're designed to be workers and doers. You know this, and I know this, and I'm learning this. Native America needs a tangible presence of God. They need to see that because they've been told for so long that it looks this way. And on the Rosebud Reservation, where my wife and I were pouring into the church and building church, we began to realize something. It's very important that Native America experienced healthy love. Not the scratch and sniff, not the emotional stuff. Real healthy love. A love that teaches, that guides, that disciplines, that corrects, that supports. This is the character, is it not, of Christ, our Savior? And so we began to realize, my wife and I, that it was so important to begin to hold a line. Like many churches with Native America, we saw very quickly that it would become very easy, and as a ministry-based organization, to get stuck in the visible poverty. In the visible poverty. You know, the lack of food in the fridge, the cold house without propane, the inability to have a car to get them to appointments and do things. I mean, there are a ton of things. And you can get stuck there doing a bunch of great, wonderful things, but never hitting the mark, never spending time with the people that need to know Jesus. And so we had to make some hard decisions. And we began to build the church on that. And the amazing thing is, when you hold that line of excellence and you stand in that character with Christ and you ask, your way, Lord, your will, your way, and your patience, the amazing thing is it syncs up with his timing. You don't have to worry about trying to organize things as they come. It works. You finally begin to hitch up with people. I'm not a pastor. I didn't go to the reservation to be a pastor. I went to the reservation because I felt like the Lord called me. I'm a master cheesemaker by design. I went to school in Vermont, the university in Vermont. The ministry that got me cleaned up and a representation of Christ and what it looks like in my life, this drug and rehab place said, we're having a dairy, we're making a production of dairy, we want to bottle milk, we want to make cheese. Will you go to school and be our master cheesemaker? And I said, why not? I can make grilled cheese sandwiches. And so for 6 years, they flew me in and out of Vermont every 5 weeks for 20 days at a time and just schooling and lab work. And then one day in 2009, I pulled out of the production parking lot, my white boots and white fatigues, and I smelled like whey, Some of you might know what that means. Cheese curds in my hair, and we just got done cheddaring cheese, and I pulled up to get ready to turn on the highway and head home to my new wife that I convinced I was a good guy. And the Lord spoke to me very simply. He says, go love your people. That's all he said. I didn't doubt. I heard it clearly. As clearly as hopefully you can hear me this morning. Go love your people. I didn't try to categorize it. I didn't try to make it, you know, try to dialogue with God about it. What is the definition of this? What are you trying to tell me? What does this look like? I went and told my pastor, and right away, he says, let's send you. I'll send you every month for 2 weeks out of every month, and I'll finance it for you, and we'll send you out there. And are you ready to go? Do you want to go? And I said, no, I want to wait. And I think there's some things in my character that need to be looked at, so I want to tell the elders. And I want you to watch me. I want you to pay attention to me. Because I know what addiction can do. We're assassins with our tongues. People with addictions are assassins with their spoken word. We're so good at getting you convinced that our motive or what we want to do next is right and good. We're perfect at it. We know how just to work you. We know how what to say that will touch your emotions just perfectly. And so I wanted my character to be right. I waited 2 years. When I finally went back to my pastor, I said, I think I'm ready to go. And he says, I gave up on you. I thought you weren't going to go anymore. He goes, now you want to go? And I said, I think it's time. Being patient. Being patient allows us to have a tangible God in our lives through experience and relationship with others. And when those relationships and those experiences happen with men and women of God, God becomes a tangible, touchable thing, and we gain from that. That's why we gather. When we got there, it seemed most like the most logical thing to do was to just open the Bible. I had one Bible at the time. It was the Bible my parents gave me at my high school graduation. It was dedicated to me. I loved it. If you know anything about me, one of the things you'll know about me is when I get things like that, I have my grandmother's Bible. When she passed, the only thing I asked from her home was her Bible. And I had that tiny little abridged version, the NIV. It was in red letter. It was big letter. I loved it. And it meant so much to me that my parents would give that to me at my high school graduation. I'd carried it with me all these years, all through my addiction years. Never opened it, of course. But boy, it was safe in my memorabilia. And 2 weeks after moving to Pine Ridge, or to Rapid City, we did an outreach into Pine Ridge, and I came up on a guy that was just, he was struggling. He was coming down. He was coming down from a drunk. People who struggle with addictions have a brief moment. There comes brief moments. If you know somebody who struggles with addiction, you might have experienced a brief moment where they speak clearly. We speak clearly. We can speak to the depth of our heart in those brief moments. It's that, the tip. We're at that moment where anything can happen before we give way and we go back to the drink. And this guy, and I felt like this guy was at that moment because he was also an alcoholic, and I understood. And I was talking to him, I was opening my word, and I was getting it out, and I was pulling to a scripture, and then I thought, I'm supposed to give this to him. And I thought, oh, I can't give him my only Bible. My parents gave it to me. It's dedicated to me. It's got a smiley face my dad put in there. I love this Bible. It means so much to me. I can't give this away. Take it. My wife saw it, and she goes, isn't that the Bible your parents gave you? And I said, yeah, but it doesn't belong to me. I began to understand. I think sometimes we forget. This is wonderful. But if you profess Jesus Christ as your personal Savior, then the Spirit that dwells within you makes you that light of hope to every man and woman and child that doesn't know the power of the cross. That makes you wonderful. That gives you purpose. The difficult situations you see, be the light. If you still are trying to understand what it is to become the light, then be humble. Spend time with those who have the wisdom. And it looks like a lot of you have wisdom. Native America needs to experience you. First Nation people doubt Christianity. Why? Because the words that are spoken and the nature of the character hasn't aligned rightly in a lot of ways. Our church back in Rosebud is in a process right now. They're struggling. They know better than to call me when they're struggling, because I say, "You're struggling? Good." Oh, that is great. There's nothing like the struggle. When I spend time with people who are coming to know who Jesus is and they say, "I'm struggling with an issue in my life," great, you're not supposed to be comfortable in sin. You should be struggling. This is God trying to get your attention. This is a Jesus moment. And so our leadership team back there, because we didn't just set in a pastor, we didn't ordain a pastor to just go in and do a job, we set together a leadership team. And they're calling me about twice a week, and they said, "Next week we have a gathering. We've been going out to a community on the Rosebud Reservation, and it's called Antelope. And we've got 50, 60 people coming. And I think maybe we should be feeding them." Feed them. I feel like we should have some activities. Do activities. Play basketball. Do Foursquare. Foursquare is a thing of the 70s. I know, but still, it can be a fun thing. And they said, "What should we do next? How soon should we start inviting them to church?" I said, "Don't invite them to church. You are the church. Be the church. It's not important for them to come here. It's important to them to experience Jesus within you. Because if you try to make that goal of getting them to church, then it becomes an institutional thing. Be the living word in the moment. Be there. Be in the moment. There's enough of us who have forgotten that never get to where we're supposed to be in the moment. Are you here this morning? Are you here? You see, when I went into that program for alcoholism, I fasted from my kids for a year. I didn't see them, all three of my kids, I didn't see them for a year. And I didn't speak to them for a year. The very first day of my program, I went into a small little chapel, slightly bigger than this area where your musicians are. I just got down on my hands and knees and I said, "You're first, Jesus. I'm going to give you a year of my life. You're first. Not my folks, not my kids, nothing. But if we don't get it straightened out after a year, I'm going to go back to drinking. But this first year, I'm giving it to you." I knew that once I heard the voice or saw the little ones, my heart was gone. Then I was just doing time. I was just going through a process. I wasn't making the Lord first. And I desperately needed that in a tangible way. So I had to be what I needed to be in that moment to make God first. I had to be humble. I had to be moldable. I had to be teachable. There's one word for that. I had to be humble. I had to have humility. Native America needs to experience us. Is it going to be difficult? Absolutely. Do you remember how difficult you were before you got saved? Do you remember? I remember the day my father-in-law came to me to tell me that his daughter was going to divorce me. And it was a last-ditch effort on his behalf. He's a short little five-footer, Swedish guy, so he was 4x4. Blonde hair. And he came in, and he was such a great guy. And he stood there across the kitchen table from me in my little one-bedroom apartment. And he said, Paul, my daughter, he said, she's thinking that she needs to go ahead and divorce you. And I'm just hoping beyond hope that maybe there's a chance we can get this figured out, straightened out. And I'm willing to walk with you. Walked over to the fridge, pulled out a fridge, took out two beers, put one on the table for him, put one in front of me, popped it. I said, you go ahead and tell her to divorce me. I don't care. I started drinking. After I finished drinking, I noticed he was crying. You know, the whole time I was drinking beer, I was urinating on myself. I didn't even know it. We're called to those difficult positions. 5 minutes. We're called to go there. This cannot be the highlight of your walk of faith. The highlight is when you get to stand with someone who doesn't know the Lord, who doesn't know the power of the cross. And that when it comes down to that simple prayer, I need you, I need you, I need you, so that they can understand there is a greater poverty without the Lord than the mere poverty of going without a car, food, propane. That poverty is where people can grow. They get healed here. Because when they come toe-to-toe with the Lord and they get humble, powerful things can happen. Amazing things can happen. But you got to be in the moment. When I woke up in the Liberty Hospital 36 hours later, and they just pulled that, you know, the breathing thing out of my chest, and the nurses were around me, and the doctor came, and they said, we're going to unhitch you. You were a little bit violent when you came in, Paul. Are you okay? And I said, I'm fine. My wife and our three children, actually down in Texas, had been vacationing because I had been trying to get to Iowa, like I said, to go see my folks for the weekend because I had to work yet. And her younger brother had pulled up. He'd driven up from Hayes, Kansas, all the way to Kansas City, about a 6.5-hour drive. And he came walking in. He was young and still had all his hair and great-looking guy. He came in. He says, man, what's going on? So I shared my story. And he'd known that I'd been a drinker for quite some time. He says, what do you think? Do you think this is gonna get you turned around? I had these metal staples. I looked like Frank. They'd shaved my head and had metal staples all the way back here behind my head. And I said, you know what? If they'd let me out of here right now, I'd go find a drink. I'm not done drinking. He started crying. This 20-year-old kid, he just started crying. It's ugly when people struggle with doubt. It's a difficult place. And when we know it, and we're in tune with the truth of where we're at, I was being as honest with him as I could. If they'd have let me out there that day, I'd have gone find a bar or a liquor store or a convenience store. I would have started drinking beer immediately. It sounds horrible, but it's the truth. And it's the truth that Native America, in my opinion, needs to experience in learning to speak. Not the illusion, Mokaham Discipleship Center, where I've just recently, in the last month, taken on the position as the director. I want them, those who will come, the students that will come from different directions, the four directions, as we say, I want them to realize that in the relationship with Jesus, we dig deep. We're going to get down to the foundation and realign those bricks, those that flooring again. That in that foundation of faith in the Lord, there's going to be accountability. There's going to be transparency. There's going to be a level of honesty that they may not have only experienced except when they got saved. That they're going to understand that there needs to be a coming together like this and sharing the truth of where they're at and being humble. I need you, I need you, I need you. It's just like that. I can make a laundry list. You know, there's an ingredient list that goes into making cheese. Tons of things, calcium, rennet, cultures, things like this. And they're all a part of the process of making this cheese. Well, we have an ingredient list. There are things that have made us to the point that now here we are, walking out our relationship with the Lord. Share it. Make it known. Native America needs to know we're not perfect just because we gather here in a beautiful facility and a wonderful time of worship, that we come from a brokenness that didn't know the Lord. We need that. I have people that come to church on the Rosebud Reservation that said, I showered up and I smudged before I got here. I got cleaned up before I came to church. I'm glad you're here. I'm glad you're, you know, smudging. I should be careful. I speak about these things usually with smudging. We smoke ourselves in order to spiritually cleanse ourselves so it devoids the need of Jesus. Take them. I went to a sweat before I came here this past weekend because I need some things done, some tobacco pulled together. Can you do that? Normally I have my medicine. Come on in here. We'll talk about that. Take them. Be that light of hope. You support us. Mokaham Ministry. This is the area I'm not very good at, so I just have to say it like it is. This church supports Mokaham Ministry, supports my leadership, Paul Straubel. And you're going to support me, I believe, or the position. Thank you. It means a great deal to us, me and my wife. It's a blessing to us. When my wife said, what are we going to do this summer? She said, I won't have a job and you won't have a job. And, you know, as you know, this is a missional position. I said, man, isn't there anything better than living out of the suitcase and living off credit cards? Trust God. He's going to do it. We're called to this. It'll work out, honey. And she goes, you know what? You're crazy. And you drive me wild with this faith walk, but we're going to do it. I want to read something to you in the book of James, chapter 1. Consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials in many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance. Let perseverance finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking in anything. If any of you lacks wisdom, you should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to you. Last verse, important verse. When you ask, you must believe and not doubt. Because the one who doubts is like a wave on the sea, blown and tossed by the wind. Because the mind doubts at times, because we doubt at times, and this may not be necessarily connected to the heart. You can talk about that unity. I'm sure your pastor does. When the mind and heart are connected, the emotional heart, the fragility of our ego, But when they are connected and people get to see what that looks like inside of you, it produces patience. When the mind and the heart are connected and they're unified for the intent of why you spend time who are lost, you're patient because you realize what God can do. You realize the power of the cross. I never spend time trying to teach or guide people when they come to our reservation on how to interact with people. They're just people. We're Native Americans, but we're just a people. And we're confused. And we've finished and figured out a way to do things organically, habitually, ceremonially. We figured that out. You know, if we're not going to humble ourselves before the Lord, before Jesus, then we're going to smudge. If we don't know how to ask Jesus for forgiveness, we're going to go into a sweat. And if we don't know and have an expectation for God to heal us, we go through ceremonies. Wanipi ceremonies, dangerous ones, demonic. Be the light in that moment. I think you are. I'm glad that I've had these few moments to share with you a little bit about what we're doing. I appreciate you immensely. I appreciate what you're doing to support us all these years, even up until this point. I love to fight. I'm not good at it, but I love to fight. I love to spend time with people who dislike Jesus. I love to spend, I'm supposed to be in those moments. But so are you. You're supposed to be in those moments.